And that was the silky sounds of the Sid Dale Orchestra with Walk and Talk from 1968. That song may be familiar to you because it is the music from the podcast of Mr. Adam A. Dawson, who is up next here on CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph and surrounding area. And Adam is about to blow a gasket, so anyway, on with the show. This is it. You're listening to Open Sources Guelph here on... No, okay. Let it rip, Donaldson.
I told you to press the wrong button.
Let it rip, Donaldson.
Oh, my God. That almost worked.
That's our new show, Sea Talk Nightly. Welcome to Sea Talk Nightly.
Not with the Sea Talk again.
Okay.
No.
Anyway.
No. No.
Okay, verboten. Next.
No. Welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz here on the... No. Okay, can it. Scotty Hertz here. Ready for action.
We'll fix it in post. Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen. And you can download the Open Sources podcast from Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. So today, now that we've got the silliness out of the way, we're going to talk about the burgeoning protests in the U.S. from young people pushing for action on gun violence and access to guns. Might this finally be the breaking point for America and the phenomenon of mass shootings? And then it's a double election year with the province and the municipalities. So let's talk about how we fund our cities and whether there's a better way. And could one of those ways be a municipal sales tax? And at least one group representing Ontario cities seems to think so. And then finally, we're going to talk about jury duty and the criminal justice system and whether it's being well serviced by the way we handle juries in terms of compensation. And are we unintentionally shrinking the jury pool? Those are some interesting questions. But first, we're going to talk about the latest from the PC leadership race, which less than 24 hours after last week's show, dramatic new developments when Patrick Brown submitted his papers to run for his old job just under the wire. And he is allowed to run. There was that meeting at PC headquarters yesterday, and they gave him the thumbs up or the maybe mildly irritated shrug, you know, whatever.
Yeah, you have to wonder what was going on behind the scenes of that meeting. This is a race that I think the likes of which we've never seen, possibly ever. I don't recall this kind of... Mm-hmm. It's not really a nail-biter in the scheme of things, but something is happening like every day and weekly, and it's like, what the heck is going on? I'm fairly surprised that he was allowed to run. I don't know if you saw it, but it seems Patrick Brown currently has his own little seat off in the corner at Queen's Park. Nobody puts baby in the corner, but they put Patrick Brownie in the corner.
Well, that was the weird development first thing Friday morning, which was Vic Fedeli, the interim leader, came out and said, oh, he's out of the caucus, by the way. Legislature's back on Tuesday. He's out of the caucus, and so he gets a little seat in the corner all by himself as an independent MPP. And then that kind of blasé-faire news was kind of run off the front page when he went to PC headquarters, you know, at 4:45 and submitted his papers to run for leader again.
It's like those people wait till the last second to register municipally, and it's like, I'm in, wait, I'm in!
Or hand in their term papers.
So John Turmel, usually. Yeah. But he's probably listening.
He's never coming on our show.
No. Never, ever. So, yeah, question period reconvened. Parliament reconvened at Queen's Park, and it's not, I don't think it was like the hotbed, because all the talk is obviously outside of there right now.
Right.
There was a lot happened. It's kind of moot now, and I'm not sure whether they're going to pursue it. But, of course, this week, too, Randy Hillier, well-known, he's Mr. Back-Off Government MPP. Where's he from? He's at, like... Kawartha Lakes Way, I think, somewhere. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I don't know the exact writing. He's pretty much been slamming Brown, saying we need to use the Integrity Commissioner to investigate possible breach of ethics rules, saying that Brown hasn't declared income, gifts, travel, all kinds of stuff, things he got from the nomination votes. Hillier is trying to disparage Brown and saying that, you know, you should follow the money because this guy is crooked, is essentially what he's saying. And he's not saying it within Queen's Park either, which means that whole notion of privilege that parliamentarians have, where they can pretty much say anything they like in Parliament. He's not doing that. So either he's got the goods on Brown somehow, or strongly suspects that there is something wrong with Brown's integrity, which is already called to question in other ways, or he's, you know, it's a Hail Mary move to kind of get Brown's sideline. And also, I think I saw before airtime that Carol Mulroney came out and said, look, you know, we got to kind of sideline this guy.
Yeah, she
which
did
you can't that. Really, right? I mean, if he's,
well, he's
in
the leadership,
if
yeah.
he's in, he's in. So I'm really looking forward to the next debate just because.
It is fascinating because I was just thinking about this, that all five of the leaders, well, Patrick Brown aside, but everyone else in the leaders debate or in the leaders race is not in Queen's Park right now. They are all prospective candidates, and Brown is the only one who has a seat in Queen's Park. And that seat is not in the Conservative caucus. Randy Hillier, by the way, is the MPP for Lanark, Frontenac, Lennox, and Addington.
So it was sort of close. No, yeah. Not really. I'm not one of those people that everything east of Toronto is just whatever, but I love that neck of the woods,
yeah, you
actually.
Are.
No. Family sort of in Peterborough.
But I mean, the ethics thing is the, I think, the thing getting warmed over because of the accusations and the, is it fake news? And did CTV do its due diligence in the reporting? And, it, you know, him taking two lie detector tests and feeling vindicated. And, you know, I think the other PC candidates, too, probably did their part by saying, you know what, if he clears his name, sure, he can come back into caucus. And I think between that and the charm offensive on Global News you know, maybe his own, I guess, like, narcissist desire to be premier, you know, gave him kind of permission to keep going on with this. But yeah, the elephant in the room is the nominations.
Mm-hmm.
Where do all those nominations, all the membership papers, I mean, all the extra members he apparently recruited, that the paperwork isn't there, or the money is missing from those memberships, the things that Hillier's brought up, which include, like, maybe basically buying off someone to run in Brampton. You know, he offered, like, a stake in his restaurant and other, like, to sell this person air miles. I didn't know air miles had, like, that kind of, like, liquidity that you could move
it's
air
like
miles.
It's like cryptocurrency or something.
It's like cryptocurrency.
Give him some air miles. And then, oh, man, I really need those air miles.
And then the other thing is
RSP.
The nomination papers, because Fedeli tossed out the two nominations in Ottawa and Scarborough Center. And then there's, like, actual police investigations for the one in Hamilton. So, I mean, there's a lot of dirt surrounding Patrick Brown. And on top of that, Martin Cohen in The Star wrote what I thought was an interesting thing, where he said that the Brown candidacy is a poster boy for politicians who never grow up or give up because they don't know how to take no for an answer, which is a fascinating way to look at it, because, you know, he has this very kind of frat boy kind of lifestyle where he's, like, hanging out in the clubs, and
it's a really expensive house, which has also come up too. It's like, how is he paying the mortgage on
well this? His house that his parents apparently helped him with the down payment of, which a lot of people can relate to. So it's like, you know, you're not really representing the little man here, Patrick Brown, which has always been the conservative bent. And then there was the whole things with, like, his 23-year-old girlfriend who might have been a staffer in his office or was a staffer in his office when he was MP. And there's just the kilotonnage of stuff. And this isn't just about the accusations. This is about someone who's kind of been in the catbird seat waiting for his time to be premier and kind of trying to look as bland as possible. And maybe this is the fault of, you know, the media and those in the media, that we haven't kind of gotten to know Patrick Brown as well as we should. And I think we've talked about that in the show on the lot. We don't really know a lot about him, because when he was MP in Ottawa, all he did was kind of, like, sit in the backbench and shuffle papers. Not that that's not all you do when you're an MP backbencher, but he didn't really propose any legislation all the years he was there. He didn't really participate in committees or anything. And
no.
It's this guy was kind of a blank slate, waiting for somebody to fill in the blanks on him. And now we kind of have, and it's, you know, that's, I mean, it's a shame.
Well, that's the thing. And going back to Ottawa, I mean, he had, if I understand it right, he had a very poor attendance record because he was running so hard to get the top job with the Ontario PCs that he was absent I was going to say absent without excuse, absent without leave. He just sort of bailed because, well, I'm a backbencher anyway, whatever. At least that's my impression of it. And the girlfriend appearing to me is really weird. And I don't want to get too gossipy on this show, but any of the sort of pre-everything that happened, and you were saying we don't know that much about Brown, there would be an article, pick your magazine, Chatelaine, Toronto Life, or in the newspapers about Brown's life, and it was always the two things were he's a teetotaler and he doesn't have time for a relationship. Oh, I'd love to have children, but I don't have time for a relationship. Then all of a sudden, all they're talking about this week and getting pictures out is of this young woman. And I suppose age gaps and that's probably not really the issue. I think the issue to me is that this woman was an intern of some description. Yeah. Like you're saying, didn't she work for him? Do you have absolutely no friends outside of work, Patrick Brown? Right? Is there no, like, it seems to me it's like the family, it's the people within the office that he knows. And I know that happens a lot, but this woman, nothing against her directly, but she seems to kind of have appeared from nowhere because there's a line where it's like she's not there and then all of a sudden she's on the radar. Prior to that and prior to the accusations that came down, it was like, well, I don't have time for relationships at all. Now all of a sudden it seems this woman had been traveling places with him, mm-hmm. whether it was a staff or as the girlfriend partner. You don't seem to know. And whether that would come out in the integrity commissioner's inquiry, if it does happen, I don't know. But it's just weird how she just sort of appeared out of the ether. And just this week, when everything's supposed to be cool, he's smiling a lot. Like, he went from that running scared from the media to, like, everything's cool. I'm in this race. And I have a bit of sympathy for the other candidates in this because this is how it's going to go. He will, other than, what's called the anal sex woman? Greenwich.
Oh, what?
It's not really
Tanya Allen.
Tanya Allen, we'll call her, aka anal sex candidate. That she's not advocating.
That's a misnomer. She's not in favor of anal.
No. But I mean, I see her and hear her name, and I think about her comments at the TVO debate. He is quite literally, even if there isn't another debate or isn't at the next debate, all of the air is getting sucked out of everything. You don't hear about what the other's doing. I know that Doug Ford was in Peterborough-Lindsay.
Yeah.
Carol Mulroney, all she said was he shouldn't really run. Not much from Christine Elliott. So all that stuff of people on the campaign trail, you're not hearing any of that. And then, did you go see Carol Mulroney when she was in town? Or was that invite only? Did you stop by?
It was public. It was on her Facebook, but I didn't go. It was like, it didn't seem like much.
No, it was just...
It's just like a little meet and
whistle
greet.
Stop or whatever.
Yeah.
It got the photo thing in the today, but...
Yeah.
Other than that, it's like, I don't know. They still don't have a candidate yet, do they, in Guelph?
No.
There's no conservative?
No.
Yet?
No.
Well, if there is conservatives out there listening, let us know, because we'd love to have you on.
I mean, everybody knows Thomas Mooney, because Thomas Mooney, you know, refused to take part in the nomination process because... of the nomination fight shenanigans, and this was last summer, but yeah, we don't have a Guelph candidate yet.
Cutting it close,
and I mean, there's even difficulties there too. With that, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, Cambridge, where the I don't know, I haven't followed up with that yet to know if the dentist from Calgary ever actually moved to Cambridge so she can run in the next election.
That's like kind a world of an record important, parachute candidate.
Yeah, I mean, kind of a world
distance wise,
kind of important because you know Cambridge is kind of a bellwether.
Yeah,
and a Liberal cabinet minister, a substantial cabinet minister, currently holds that seat. Friend of the show, Catherine McGarry.
Yes.
And this is a party that is a shambles. But, the one thing they kind of have going for them is that, you know, in a kind of just party line a vote, the Conservatives beat the Liberals fairly handily. The question is, what does that look like in the event of, I think, the unlikely event of the Patrick Brown gets his job back? Because I think that's something everyone's dealing with the circus and not dealing with the fact, like, what if Patrick Brown gets his job back? What is that going to look like? And how is that going to appeal? I mean, that may please some of the people in the base who think that this was a conspiracy out to get him. But I mean, that's not going to win you independent votes. That's not going to get you crossover votes from people who might lean liberal or NDP or even Green. Mm-hmm. Doug Ford is a lightning rod.
Oh, definitely.
He's very much a figure who could say one thing in the first week of the campaign that will lose the PCs the election, a la Hudak, a la Tory. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that leaves Carolyn Mulroney, too, who's kind of a question mark. You know, there was a lot of energy when she first entered the race. That energy seems to have dissipated because Brown has, you know, made the circus more circusy. And then that leaves Christine Elliott, who does bring the background, the experience, the establishment, being runner-up twice before, and is probably the safest choice. Whether or not, you know, PCs are going to want to go for a safe choice, that's a big question.
Christine Elliott seems to be getting the best press. I'll say that.
Sure. When she gets press, though.
Filtering through the articles, it's like, if you're going to read anything positive, saying she's our best choice, whether it's editorialized or just, you know, and it's like, it sounds like the movement is on to that she is the best pick. But of course, it is a race on. There's no one has been chosen yet, so we shall see. But I think the establishment seems to be leaning towards her.
I think the establishment would like it if she was it. But this isn't kind of a race where you can. I mean, maybe you can. Andrew Scheer certainly wasn't an exciting candidate, and he was able to win. But you know, you have Carolyn Mulroney, who's like new and fresh and fancy, and you have Doug Ford, who you know, has all that, you know, razzmatazz from the Ford era around him. And you have Patrick Brown, who's like doing his own one-man three-ring circus, and then you have Tanya Allen, who you don't know much about her, but you know she's definitely not in favor of anal sex in the classroom.
No.
And it's hard to be the Shemp in that. it's hard to be Harpo in that Marx Brothers of the campaign. Anyway, lost a train of thought there. Anyway, we're going to talk about another circus south of the border. And it's funny, we were talking backstage on the show last week. but we were saying, like, how, you know, we weren't thinking about covering this, and we frankly didn't know how to cover this differently from what's happened before with mass shootings in the United States. And then these mm-hmm. kids started speaking out, and it's like, okay, well, that's the angle, because it seems that this has gotten people to talk about this in a new way and broken through the typical cycle of, you know, school shooting thoughts and prayers. Let's talk about gun control. No, we're not going to talk about gun control. It's too soon. And then it goes away, and then the whole thing starts again. And I think, like, the great symbol of that is the fact that CNN last night had this amazing town hall with little Marco Rubio.
Little Marco Rubio, yeah.
And a Democratic Congressman, Bill Nelson, who's a Florida senator. Where they were asked very pointed questions by some of the kids who were at Parkland about gun control, and there's no way that if the kids hadn't started talking, that CNN would have allocated. I mean, we would have been over this by now. We would be talking on to the next stupid thing Trump tweeted by now. Or the fact that Mueller just added 35 charges to Manafort and Gates like an hour ago.
Oh, boy. So that might be one for next week.
That might be one for
next week. Definitely.
Yeah. But
the charges just keep piling up.
But a week later, we're still talking about this, and that's mm-hmm. because I think the kids really stepped up to bat.
And it's excellent. I mean, and this, I think, is what is needed, a bit of life breathed into the whole gun control debate, because that's what's been lacking, as we've said in the past, to be shooting, and it's like, whatever, ta-da. And when you become kind of indifferent to these things, that's when it starts to not fall off the radar, but it's like it just becomes accepted fact, and these kids are saying enough. That's, what's her name, Emma Gonzalez? Mm-hmm. The speech, it made all of the media that I saw, it's everywhere, like, you know, we call BS. Mm-hmm. An activist is born. Right? Out of this, right? You can tell. And it, of course, it's taken a turn for the weird, with the people saying, oh, these people are, all these kids are paid actors.
Crisis actors.
Yeah, the conspiracy people.
Which is a term I never heard before until this week. Crisis actors. Give me a break.
But conspiracy theorists have jumped all over it. But the best comment, and I didn't catch the kid's name, it was, He was asked on CNN, what do you think conspiracy theorists, what do you think about these conspiracy theorists saying about you guys are paid actors? And he said, if they saw me in Fiddler on the Roof, they would know that no one would pay me to act. And I was like, but that is the best comment. And in some ways, that's what's needed. I mean, this kid was obviously quick on the draw, had something to say.
I think he had that line in the bag.
I know, but... there's definitely something afoot here that it isn't just going to be, they're not going to sit back and take it anymore. And something kind of in parallel news, it was walkouts in the schools in Florida. But the superintendent, I guess, for the schools, a school district in Houston, Texas, said, if you walk out, you will be suspended 3 days, no questions asked, even if your folks, even if your parents... your people sign off on it. It's like, you're going to be suspended regardless. And of course, all of this is fuel to the whole getting this debate some degree of press, right? Even if it's even if it's negative to a degree, but I don't know, nobody thinks that that's negative. I mean, it's great the students are energized and wanting to protest because that's where it has to come from. Absolutely.
Well, I mean, it's powerful because it's... I forget who said it. I think I was watching MSNBC or CNN or one of those. But somebody said, you know, you always hear this line after the shooting, you know, it's too soon to talk about it. Well, these are the people who were shot at. So if it's not too soon for them to talk about it, that excuse goes out the window.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's it shouldn't be – the whole conspiracy theory craziness is based on the idea that teenage kids – can't be articulate and they can't, you know, devise, you know, protest and media strategy. It's like a lot of these kids are like a year, 2 year away from university where that's going to become second nature for a lot of them. When you look at some of the kids here who are, you know, within the same age bracket and who know how to protest and know how to rally and know how to make a speech, it's not that hard to believe. But especially in a media savvy age such as this, and this is what the kids are playing on, it's like this media savviness. And of course, who is that going to have a pronounced effect on? But the president who watches more TV than every other president that's ever been in office since the invention of TV combined, because of course the people were saying that over the weekend at Mar-a-Lago, Donald Trump was going around getting the wisdom of the ages that is at his country club about. About whether there should be bans and whether or not, you know, what kind of actions he should be taking. So, you know what? Clearly, these, you know, kids having grown up in the media culture of the internet clearly know what it's going to take to appeal. And I think that's something that, you know, the Dinesh D'Souzas of the world can't appreciate. Dinesh D'Souza, who's like just a... something else entirely, is, you know, went to jail basically for breaking finance law because he was getting people to donate to a candidate and then paying them back, which is kind of a
money laundering essentially, right?
Essentially, so it, I mean, it's really kind of hard for these guys to wrap their head around, because and it's also scary. I mean, there's been a visceral response to this too, because it's scary because these kids are a couple of years away from voting age. Florida is a swing state.
Yeah, and I didn't know this, that you can, if you're going to be voting age as of the day, you can register in advance.
Yep.
So there's people, I guess, what is it, 18?
I think you can do that here too, but yeah.
So yeah, and I think it sounds like there's a movement to encourage young people to do that, especially those of the mind that we need gun control and they want to elect people that will, you know, bring that to the front burner where it belongs, obviously. But it's it's something else. And I hope in a way that the momentum can keep going for them, because this is the type of thing where, you know, it sort of goes up and can kind of sparkle for a while, but then can very easily get knocked down by something else. Hopefully it isn't another shooting somewhere. Which would definitely play into what they're advocating for, but at the same time would be the worst possible scenario in terms of getting any attention for gun control. So this, I've heard some talk about, it's like, you know, this is First Amendment versus Second Amendment. So you've got, you know, the NRA people who are all pro Second Amendment. You've got these young people speaking their minds, First Amendment right in America, and those amendments are obviously untouchable, right? But you could come up with another amendment that says, look, you know, we really, assault rifles, no. They could do that.
They could, but it's
that's probably not the level it's going to happen.
The practical constitutional arguments, though, I think have been tried in the past, and they're not going to fly. And there was a teacher at that town hall last night who asked the, I can't remember her name, I think her name was Dana Roach, but she's a spokesperson for the NRA, and she's like, can you define like what a well-regulated militia is? And of course, Roche didn't have an answer, but I mean,
they leave that part off all the time,
right?
So chop.
But the constitutional arguments have been weak. What I think of is, you know, particularly persuasive, at least for me, is like hearing the stories about like the Scott Beagle, who was a geography teacher, who like
stood
like, ushered, got like several students into a classroom before he was shot and killed. Apparently he had left instructions with his fiance about what to do in the event that he was killed in a school shooting.
Really? It's come to that.
Yeah, and there are kids who say like their parents save voicemail messages from them in the event of, you know, that kids are, you know, how can you live in a world like that? It's bizarre, you know, where you can send your kid to school every day and wonder, you know, might they come home?
I could fully understand people in the States that want to homeschool their kids.
You know, on the basis of safety,
on the basis of safety, I could totally see it. It's like, you're just not going to go anymore. Mm-hmm. We're gonna take care of it. But yeah, I mean, I hope it. What was it that same superintendent in Houston was saying that school or, you know, is not the place for political protest? But I mean, to me, it's like the exact place. If they don't get energized at that age about things such as this, then you know what's gonna happen in the future. You just kind of sit back and go, another shooting. Oh,
you sit every lesson in school outside of like science. Well, not even outside of science, but outside of like maybe math and gym. Mm-hmm. Every lesson in school is about some kind of radical. You know, even in science, you know, people like Galileo Galilei and Copernicus were radicals. You know, in English class, you know, Shakespeare was not someone from a higher caste. This is what, you know, kind of boggles my mind when people talk about the snootiness of Shakespeare. Shakespeare was a working class playwright. You know, in your history class, you're talking about Martin Luther King. You're talking about, you know, the suffragettes. You're talking about the people in the Revolutionary War.
The movers and the shakers.
The movers and the shakers, who were not part of the quote unquote establishment, and whom, you know,
none of them sat back. Right? That's, it was like, just let her go.
When George III heard about the Declaration of Independence, he wasn't like, "Oh, good for them, good for them. We'll let them have a go. We'll see how it goes." No, of course not.
The British are coming.
They weren't. Yeah. They weren't hosing down black civil rights marchers in Selma because they were dirty. It was right.
Yeah,
that's what you're sitting there learning in history class is that, you know, you know, radicals, yesterday's radicals are tomorrow's heroes and leaders, and
you're getting a statue.
You should be surprised that, you know, school isn't a place where kids are going to learn how to be politically active. It's just nuts. Anyway, let's leave that there. We're going to take a break.
Good place.
And come back with a little more philosophical news items. And we're going to talk about municipal sales taxes and whether or not you should be better compensated for your jury duty. If you want a bail on the show, now's the time. I'm kidding. Stick around. This is important
hot tips
stuff
to follow, yes.
Anyway, you're listening to Open Sources here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Second line stepping high, raising hell as we roll along. Gentilly to Vukeray, low and nice central city of town. Singing Giacomo Finale, this city won't ever drown. Doesn't matter, cause there ain't no way I'm ever gonna leave this town. This city won't wash away. This city won't ever drown.
That was the unmistakable voice of, I was going to say Jackie Washington, not Jackie Washington, Jackie Robinson. Jazz, new into the station. The band is called the Heavyweights Brass Band. And that song was This City. I believe that was Steve Earle's song for New Orleans. So This band is very big on New Orleans jazz, mostly instrumentals, but that's something in there by Jackie Richardson, who is a stalwart of the jazz scene. So I really should host a music show and just get a bunch of CDs and knock them together. And yes, so check it out. It's on Orange Groove Records.
Oh, is that why there's an orange? Okay.
Yes, that's why there's that funky orange on the front there, yeah.
It's like, ain't no oranges in New Orleans. I mean, maybe there is, but I don't think they grow
there. Canada either, but maybe anyway, it's theirs.
This isn't a food store. No. This isn't a food store either. So it's an election year, obviously. There's a provincial election in June, then there's going to be a municipal election in October. And one of the things that always comes up around budget time at city council is the fact that, you know, we struggle to manage funding the city on top of managing the tax burden, which is property taxes, how the city manages to raise most of its revenue. And the Association of Municipalities Ontario is proposing that there needs to be a change in how that is. And one of the suggestions they're making is a municipal sales tax, which is not a crazy idea. And it has been an idea that's been implemented in other places, maybe most famously in New York City, where they raise billions of dollars a year through a municipal sales tax. Of course, I don't think the United States does a lot of sales taxes. I don't think there are too many places with like a state sales tax, and there's no federal sales tax to my knowledge.
I don't think there's federal tax, no.
Right.
I think maybe on bigger ticket or like inter-country things, maybe, but not if you just go there.
I don't know how America works. But anyway, they have had some success there. And this is a thing that's kind of slowly catching steam. KPMG proposed the idea when the city of Toronto asked them to look at new revenue options. And KPMG said it was a very strong option to impose a municipal sales tax. And before people go like, well, we're taxed enough and I hate taxes and blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, the HST is 13%. It used to be 15%. Can it be 14%?
Sure could. I think it sounds like a lot of people would agree with it if it was directed to certain things rather than going into the pool.
Mm-hmm.
So the New York tax breaks down. It's like local is 4.5, state is 4%, and then there's a segment of that which is actually very small. It's 0.375 for transit, dedicated transit tax specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've been to New York City, you'll know. Yep. I mean, I'm sure the people who live there would say something different, but the times I've been in New York, the transit has been excellent. So I don't know. You know.
The grass is always greener, because I know a lot of people who live in Guelph and then look at like Grand River Transit in Kitchener and go like, well, that's the way you're on a transit. And people in Kitchener are like, I hate Grand River Transit. So it's.
Yeah. And the two don't connect. But you can go a long, long way in New York on one fare.
That's right.
So, but again, that's probably a whole completely different topic. Yeah. So the Association of Municipalities of Ontario, this comes up often. They've been lobbying very hard for a bigger chunk of the HST.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, this has surfaced. I think it's something like 400-plus municipalities are pushing for.
Yeah.
Not all of them, though. It seems to have flopped recently in Toronto. There was a vote.
Yeah.
Against it, saying, no, we don't want to pursue this. They were saying yes to the greater percentage of HST revenue, but they don't want to implement a tax for the city, because I guess the resistance is it's not popular. Think of Doug Ford and the whole. Plus, nobody wants property tax to go up either, because you're sort of, I wouldn't say punishing property tax people, but the majority of municipal tax comes from property tax, right? They do get other I was going to say downloads, but they do get some of the HST. And I think the province has promised to all of the municipalities that they're going to get a bigger chunk of the gasoline tax, which is kind of separate from that.
Yes.
But it still, at least in Toronto's case, wouldn't make up the shortfall at all. It's great that they're going to get that, but it still won't. I think their $33 billion worth of needs.
Yeah.
So you won't do that by just getting a chunk of the gasoline tax. You need, as they keep saying, the popular lingo is revenue tools. We're looking at different revenue tools, but they're few and far between without, you know, getting the populace up in arms, right?
Well, I mean, because you can't say tax anymore, because no. Doug Ford revenue unleashed tools. The beast.
AKA but, tax.
Yeah.
Right?
But yeah, it's... What I found interesting is that, you know, 1% would translate into like maybe half a billion for Toronto, like a little less than half a billion.
Which is great, but...
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of new revenue available. In Guelph, according to the AMO numbers, for Guelph, that would mean about 17.9 million guaranteed.
Wow.
And Guelph has a backlog of 500 million for infrastructure. And the dedicated infrastructure levy we have right now, I didn't look up the exact numbers, but it's like $2 or $3 million a year.
Right.
So by having an extra 1%, we have like five times as much than what we're putting on infrastructure levy, which, by the way, is coming from the exact same source as the money to spend on just operating the city, which is property taxes. And you're right, the property taxes do put an unfair burden on property owners.
Mm-hmm.
But it also puts an unfair burden on renters, because if the property tax goes up, more often than not, landlords just pass that on to the people renting and call it a rent increase. And property taxes also don't affect everyone exactly the same way.
No.
Because of the way you're... It's not just an general increase. It also depends on the assessment. And if you're in an area where there's a lot of building going on, where there's a lot of new property coming online, or a lot of new development...
Like the ward. Don't ask me what my property taxes are.
You're going to be, paying probably maybe even more than someone who has an equivalent house for an equivalent price on the opposite end of town where there isn't any construction, so...
Yeah, and that's the thing. The MPAC have come out and said, this is... What did MPAC come out and say? I'm totally misquoting myself, but... totally different story. But...
Municipal Property Assessment
Corporation. And they are essentially private, right?
Well, they're the ones who set the assessment prices for all properties in Ontario.
Yeah, and of course, as the build goes up, then your taxes go up. And I know what I was going to say. You know, it's when you introduce a consumption tax, it's like anything. You're taxing essentially everybody, not at the same rate necessarily. Depends on your consumption,
right?
But the perception is that it's fair, and there's all sorts of consumption taxes out there. I think an amusement tax has been floated in places where it's like, I think places simply like Niagara Falls and that have it already, where it's like, or a hotel tax where it's like,
right,
there's this money. I think in Regina, they were talking about a cannabis tax that was voted down where it's like, okay, cannabis is going to come online. How about we get 1% of that? And it's like, no. So even something like that, it's, the cannabis, legalized cannabis isn't even on stream yet. And it's still unpopular. It's like, no, we can't do that. And then there's places like London who have congestion charges. The congestion charge raises millions of pounds a year for London. And I think, didn't John Tory float that for Toronto? And it was resoundingly pounded down. It's like, no, you can't do that. Do that.
Well, he did. And I think the argument had a lot to do with the fact that Rob Ford was elected on the on the basis of getting rid of the vehicle registration tax, which was kind of like a congestion tax, and that it targeted kind of the same demographic, basically people who own their own private automobile and drive it around. But John Tory I don't think John Tory is completely shut off to the idea. And if I remember that Toronto council vote, it was to endorse the idea of more HST revenue. But the person who brought that motion, Josh Mantlow, wanted to go a further step and wanted to allocate certain funds to certain things, and that was a bridge too far, although it was a fairly close vote. But still, it's hard to have this argument when the mayor of the biggest city kind of isn't taking the lead on it. Mm-hmm. I think John Tory wants to kind of, John Tory, I mean... he can be a shrewd guy, and he certainly felt the sting of taking a stand in the past.
Oh yeah,
so
it's an election year.
Right? He's not going to stick his neck out.
No,
unless he's like guaranteed that it's not going to mean his head's going to get cut off. But it's hard for this to it's hard to imagine. No matter how many municipalities are on board, it's hard to imagine this going anywhere until John Tory's on board.
Yeah, because you need the largest city.
Or whoever's mayor of Toronto is on board, because it's not as, we'll see what happens. And
because 50 people are going to run, right?
Lord Buckethead and 49 others.
Oh, I can't wait if Lord Buckethead's coming. That'd be fantastic. But that's the thing. I mean, the shortfall has to be made up somewhere, right? There's, you have, you know, those like Doug Ford and that, they're saying, oh, cuts, your taxes are too high, always too high, too high, too high. The money has to come from somewhere. And I think this is the problem, excuse me, that they're having in Saskatchewan as well. That's why that came up, because it's like the Saskatchewan party has just cut stuff to the bone. I mean, funding comes from the provinces. Municipalities are governed by the provinces as well, or overseen by the provinces as well. So they're at the whim of that. Beyond property tax, it's like, well, we're going to give you this for this. So if the provincial government, regardless of who it is or what their party, start to cut, it's got to come from somewhere. And so they're trying the tools in the toolbox. But I don't think we'll see road tolls in Toronto anytime soon. But
well, tolls.
You should tax the marijuana. Oh my goodness.
Tolls. I mean, that's something John Tory's banking on is the road tolls for the Don Valley Parkway and the Garner Expressway. I find it hard to believe though that that's going to go because there was something else that they were thinking about imposing for people who travel in and out of the city, people who like work in downtown Toronto, but
a showing up tax.
Yeah, I mean something
you're
like that.
Toronto, we're gonna never.
Where if you live in Oakville, Burlington, Mississauga, Georgetown, even Guelph, you know, and you're going into Toronto every day to work. He was targeting something like that, and Kathleen Wynne was for it, but the outer GTA mayor started making a fuss, and then she pulled
exactly.
back. So, I mean, that's really hard, too. Toronto's a very unique case in the Canadian experience, anyway, because so many people who work in Toronto don't necessarily live there. There's so many, no. You know, you get on the GO train in the morning, it is, 20 cars packed with people all going into the city from...
We're part of that now, too.
Sure.
Right.
Kitchener. So, you know, for Toronto to address its concerns, particularly like a packed subway system... those aren't all Torontonians.
No.
And so there is a share of the ownership. Meanwhile, the municipalities and the people who live in those municipalities outside of Toronto kind of don't want to take that responsibility either, which is why kind of adding a percentage point to the HST kind of nicks us all no matter where we live.
And yeah, because I remember that argument years ago where it was like, oh, you come in Toronto, you work here, you use all of our services and everything, but you don't pay anything for it.
Right.
So, I mean, that's been the argument for years that those that go into Toronto, and it's I'm not sure, it must be a massive number every day that just file in from the GTA.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that it goes in reverse as much.
No.
But, so, yeah, this is an evolving story, I guess, because we'll see if...
Well...
Don't think it's going to happen anytime soon, but the more they talk about it, the more we're going to have to look at it. So.
Yeah. Speaking of things that should be looked at, this came out of an article we saw in the Toronto Star. And there's a report they did on how much people are compensated to be on juries. And this was actually news to me because I thought you showed up for jury duty and you weren't given anything. Because I've never
Not
been
even
on
a
jury.
Sandwich.
Yeah, well, yeah. I've never been on a jury, so I didn't know. No. But apparently after 10 days...
But you're not a property
owner,
right? So,
oh, that's fair.
That's why you wouldn't be on it. But yeah, anyway, yeah.
Score. Anyway...
it's wrong, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that is kind of messed up. But so if you're on a jury, for longer than 10 days, you get $40 a day. If you're on a jury longer than 49 days, you get $100 a day, but you don't get compensated for parking or meals or childcare, which you think you would need. I mean, if you go to the CFRU AGM, you get childcare. But if you're on a jury all day, every day, for, you know, maybe as many as 70 days, you don't get child care. And the Star and the Ryerson Journalism School did kind of an examination of this criminal case. These two people on trial for the murder of one's ex-husband, Melissa Merritt and Christopher Fetior. It was a trial that lasted 70 days, not including the two-week Christmas break, but they broke it down, and the jurors on that case made $3,660 in total for their jury duty, which comes out to about $8.71 a day, or $8.71 per hour, which is, if you'll recall, about $5 short of the minimum wage. And then they compared it to other jurisdictions, and in Quebec, that same jury would have made $7,951, or $18.90 per day, because Quebec handles its juries quite differently. So you get $103 from the first day, and then if it goes longer than 57 days, you get $160 a day, plus you get some expenses and childcare covered as well.
Yep, and if I understand it right, Newfoundland pays for everything. You just get your wage, right? You get your wage and whatever else you need, and I believe childcare as well, so everything's taken care of. And maybe that's giving people the incentive to do it, because that's something as well, is that... And you can find all kinds of advice online on how to get out of jury duty if you don't want to be part of it, right? They'll just say, no, I can't do this. And lots of people have legitimate excuses. I think if it's your job, or I think even if you've pre-booked a vacation, and I don't even know if you have to prove it, you can say, no, I'm supposed to go to Florida for 2 weeks. Well, you don't have to come. So that's the incentives are few, I think, for people to be on juries in Ontario, considering how put out you are. And the system seems a bit, like, it's, when I was reading up on it, it's like they draw the names from a drum. It's like a 50-50 draw. And you're just in the, like, pool of people. And as what has come up and been talked about when we were talking about the Bushi case and others, is that the peremptory challenge still exists. So if they don't like your face, or they don't even have to have a reason, if they decide that you... they don't want you on the jury, they can say, no, sorry. And this is something else that weeds people of a certain demographic out as well. So in Ontario, it's like you have this pool of people and they all are essentially property owners at this point. And then from that, you can weed even further. I think it's less if the case isn't a massive case, but I think in a murder case, it's as high as 20. You can go through 20 peremptory challenges and say, okay, no. So you get the numbers or the visuals or the perception that you like, that's going to help your candidate. So that's something else that needs to be addressed as well. So outdated? Absolutely. Outmoded? For sure. Like this, they really need to have an overhaul. Of course, the talk is trying things like using people's OHIP cards, using your health card, saying, okay, this is your criteria if you register with this. And this is why I was thinking about MPAC before, because MPAC, I sort of got derailed. I got a topic ahead when I was thinking of MPAC, because MPAC is saying that this, you know, what they do isn't maintaining a database of people, although it is used for that, to find the pool of jurors to draw on.
Their job, electors too.
Yeah. Their job is, and electors as well, which is, and then if you're not, in the case of elections, if you're not on that list, it's up to you to get on the list. You can't get on a jury duty list if you don't own property. It's very 1867, really. Mm. Same with the Senate, right? You have to own property to be a senator, even if it's like a square foot somewhere. I don't know about the moon, but it has to be in the Canada. So, yeah, we've got this outmoded system. That study that came out, the other study, was like from 2013, right, where that healthcare card suggestion was made, that we need to address the fact that there's lots of people that aren't represented on juries. You have a massive minority community in who are now the majority in Toronto, and yet they're not represented. Juries are generally white.
And older.
And older.
Yeah, it's... And what I found interesting is that you read some of the comments online, and this doesn't come from a place of, you know, we joke about finding tips online about how to get out of jury duty.
It's true. I mean,
it was even a joke on The Simpsons, like Homer just tell them you're prejudiced against all groups and religions and you get out of it. But there are a lot of people who want to do their civic duty.
Yeah.
A lot of people are like, yeah, I can. That would be a great experience. That would be a great way to learn, you know, learn something about the legal system, or just, you know, to carry my weight as a citizen, to contribute to society in some way, to serve on a jury. But if you are someone who is a cashier, like the story, I had this one woman who was a cashier at No Frills, and you can't say, well, I'm going to take a couple of weeks off and jury, because No Frills isn't going to pay. And that was one of the solutions proposed, is that, you know, if employers paid your salary as you were on jury duty.
The only thing.
But I mean, look at the uproar about minimum wage increase, paying people a living wage. Can you imagine if the government decided to start making, people pay you to take time off to be on a jury?
The only thing the employer legally has to give you is the time.
Yeah.
But the case could be 100 days. And if you do have the cashier job, let's say, or Tim's or anything like that, I mean, you're done. You would literally, if that was your only income, like, you're already close to the bone to begin with. How on earth would you make that work? So I mean, if there's anything that needs to happen, number one would be better compensation for people on their jury duty and something for, you know, there's children involved in that. But it's just weird that across it's evolved provincially, that it's not, you would think they would come up with a federal standard and say, this has to happen.
Yeah.
And then, and also increasing the pool as well. Cause if you're a renter, you're not on the rolls. If you're a student, you're definitely not on the rolls. If you're the spouse of someone and it's in, you know, your partner's name, you're not on the rolls either. So, and the people, you know, the young and lower income are generally excluded from that. I mean, if you are working the Tim's job, you probably don't own your place, right? So
no.
All of these things add up to, like, you're not even in the running. And then when you are in the running, there's all these other factors where they can just say, get lost. It's like, it doesn't seem right.
Right. And we're also asking, you know, people, lay people, you know, to sort of sit in on court cases, which there may be some complicated. I mean, I've been in a courtroom before.
Sure.
But I've never been on a jury, but, you know.
I have too. I pleaded guilty. No, anyway.
What?
It was traffic anyway, court.
Okay.
Yeah. But no,
I've been called as a witness, but I've not been.
Well, my thing was I had no time off. I had to take unpaid leave to go because I'd run out of, like, all options of time off.
Anyway,
those are different stories.
But back to me. Like,
yeah.
But, you know, there's legal jargon and stuff. And, you know, I wonder if we had, like, a professional jury system, like people who are, like, were paid to be there and be on juries, like, as, like, kind of a career, like a professional jury. I think that's problematic, too.
Yeah, because you would develop a bias.
Right.
Watch too many Law and Orders and think you're the...
Well, I'm not saying you just hire people willingly. I mean,
you're right.
Like, for any job, there'd be like some kind of training. But
yeah.
I think you're also in danger of, you know, creating a new professional class that, you know, well, that would have their own different biases that perhaps weren't unexpected. But at the same time, even people who can afford to take the time off may not be willing to afford to take the time off. They, you know, because, you know, we have career fields now where people work themselves to the brink of death, not taking vacations because they're concerned that if you go on a 1 week vacation, you're going to come back and find yourself replaced by someone better.
A robot. Yeah.
Or a robot. Yeah. So, you know, there are all these pressures on people from the economic angle and societal angles. And
all sides.
Yeah. So but it might be worth an experiment to take a jurisdiction for a year and say, okay, we're going to hire 50 people or whatever, and we're going to move them around from case to case to case, and they're going to be professional jury
like they
pool.
Do with mediators and,
sure.
and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I'm not saying, like, put these people on, like, the Bruce MacArthur murder trial, but, you know, maybe put them in, like, small claims court or something, or...
Yeah, somewhere where there's volume, but not necessarily the gravity of it, like a murder case.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting proposal. But, maybe that's something they should examine. You should get on that.
I should get on that.
I think it's a great idea.
Well, I am meeting with the premier next week.
I think you and Kathleen should have a one-on-one on this, and she'll say, that's the best thing I've heard. They're going to call it the Donaldson policy.
Oh, my goodness.
Just in time for the election. Shall be a juror?
I'm not sure I want my name on any policy, but there we go. I have posted online for everyone who don't know, I'm going to be interviewing the premier at the Ontario Good Roads Association conference next week. We will be having that audio, and we're going to play it on the show at some point. So I'm not sure when the audio will be made available to me because I'm not handling the technical stuff. I'm just there to interview her. But we will play that on the show for everyone to hear. So I just wanted to establish that. And with that, we'll call it a day. And opensourcesguelph.com is our website. And you can find all of our stuff there. You can go to Open Sources Newswire on Facebook, at @OS_Guelph on Twitter. And, of course, you can find this and other episodes on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play. You can find me on Twitter at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
Scott Hertz on Facebook, Scott Hertz on Twitter, and I blog at spannerbook.wordpress.com.
Great. And we'll be back here next week with more open sources. And you can find us here, as always, on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we will see you next Thursday at 5 p.m.